I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cancer Conference Update, as today we reflect back on the 2020 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, specifically as it relates to the management of triple-negative breast cancer. We did a webinar during the San Antonio meeting as a satellite there on triple-negative disease, and Dr. Kelly Markham from the Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, North Carolina, will join us today as the faculty talk about what happened at San Antonio and more as it relates to triple negative disease. Here's the original faculty we had for the webinar, and today we're going to talk about what happened since that time. But if you're interested in checking out the presentations from the webinar, if you have the slide set, just click on where it says download slides and you'll get those slides to check out. We're going to go through a few of those today, but of course not most of them. And actually, when I sat down last week and thought about what there was that happened, I thought we may want to add a little bit to it. This is a survey that we did for the big webinar during San Antonio. We'll show you some results. But I thought we could use a few cases here. And so last week, we have a whole bunch of general medical oncologists we call on to review our work and present cases. So I called Atif Hussain, who's down here in Hollywood, Florida, near us in Miami. Asked him if he could get on Zoom with me, and we talked late Friday afternoon with a bunch of cases to present, and I'm going to present several of these cases to Kelly today. Here's where we're heading. These were the original module topics that we have. We're going to touch back into them, talk about what, if anything, happened in San Antonio related to these topics. So one thing I just wanted to get started with, because honestly, there wasn't a lot of groundbreaking data, I thought, at San Antonio, at least in terms of triple negative, Kelly, but there was a symposium, an education symposium at San Antonio with a fantastic faculty. I really highly recommend it. It's on the San Antonio website. Well, I just pulled a couple slides to get Kelly to react to it, but really more to get you interested in maybe checking out the symposium. Rebecca Dent did a really interesting presentation. And Kelly, I was curious about this slide she showed. It was really, I never thought about it, which was the mutation rate, like TMB. And apparently, I guess you see a higher number of mutations with triple negative breast cancer, although it really isn't that high. Anyhow, any thoughts about that, Kelly?
Well, I think we're all still trying to explore the space to see if tumor mutational burden really does predict response in triple negative breast cancer. It is high, although I have to admit, I've been surprised the number of times I see triple negative metastatic lesions that I send for next generation sequencing at the relative paucity of mutations. So if you look at that cut point threshold, yes, it is elevated compared to, you know, luminal A ER positive tumors. But I think still we really need to understand better what its predictive function is. And I think actually Rebecca Dent, you know, I remember in her presentation said it's not just the quantity of the mutations, it's the quality of the mutations too. How many of them really are active driver mutations? So I
feel like we're talking about this every day. Last week I spent an hour and a half with Solange Peters just talking about predictors of response to immunotherapy. And of course, she's a big TMB person. And yeah, one of the other presentations in this symposium was by your colleague down the road, Lisa Carey, who we work with all the time, of course. And one slide she showed, I just picked out slides that really caught my attention, was this one. Really wild. I never didn't realize this. Really amazing showing what's happened over the last, I guess, 20 to 30 years in terms of relapse rates. Any thoughts about this?
Well, these are the kind of things as medical oncologists we need, if anything, just as a morale booster. But, you know, these data come from the British Columbia group, which was really prescient and foresighted in banking tumors, you know, way back in being able to go back and do a lot of just incredible correlative studies over the years. But, you know, with their good population-based series to be able to show by subtype, because they had the marker information or could go back and get the marker information, you know, what the outcomes are. I think it reflects what we tell our patients. These are data that I share with patients. They want to understand prognosis over time. And, you know, everybody kind of wants to know your best guess at what the future holds and what the future risks are. And these data really do show both the progress and where the residual risk is by subtype.
So Jennifer Litton also gave a presentation as a part of the San Antonio Symposium. And one of the things she mentioned, and I think we talked about this in the webinar, but I don't know, it just sort of caught my attention when I saw her presenting, was this SWOG study. It was presented last year. at ASCO, brought up the issue of veliparib. It was cisplatin with or without veliparib, and they showed a benefit there in the BRCA-like as well as the BRCA patients. But I just brought it up because, you hear things about PARP inhibitors. Now we hear them, pancreatic, prostate, ovary, all different kinds of things. And one of the themes that comes up from my point of view is, how much does PARP add to platinum? And I particularly heard this issue in breast cancer. And I know this is about combining it with PARP, so it's not purely just that question. But it is interesting that you saw a benefit with the veliparib there, adding on to platinum. Any thoughts about this, Kelly?
Well, I think for veliparib, it is important to point out it is the one PARP inhibitor that we've been able to combine successfully with chemotherapy. And so that may be perhaps accentuating some of that platinum activity. I think in that study, it also resurrects the concept of looking for BRCA-ness out of tumors as a predictor of treatment benefit. But it needs some additional validation. I think in the breast community, we'd begun to, think that was not going to be a helpful approach. But I think those data do support that we still need to give it a closer look. Veliparib's so not approved, of course, so that is a limitation, but we'll see.
Right, yeah. Yeah, ovary, it seems like even though they had a study that was positive, it kind of seems like it's never going to really hit fruition. I don't know about in breast. Yeah. Anyhow, the last presentation at this San Antonio symposium by Javier Cortez, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is the idea of a breast cancer immunogram, and particularly this issue of where the microbiome fits in this whole story. Again, Solange was going into that in detail, but any thoughts about this new sort of evolving concept, Kelly?
It's a little bit like quantum mechanics to me in the breast cancer world. It's a little hard to understand this kind of spooky action at the distance of the immune system on response to treatment, but it's been demonstrated over and over in a number of situations. So the interaction between the immune system, our microbiome, and the cancer and the microenvironment, just incredibly complex. But clearly a rife area to explore further is predictive.
So, and also he had a great discussion about management of toxicity. He had this great slide and a discussion about rechallenge and people who have toxicity. Again, really recommend that you check that out. But now let's get into some of the data that was presented at San Antonio and also just some clinical issues that we got into with the webinar that, you can continue to talk about all day long, and, we will. So, of course, maybe the biggest presentation related to triple negative was this one, update by HOPE on the Keynote 355 study. Anything you want to say about that, Kelly?
Well, I think it was an important update to follow on Peter Schmid's presentation at ESMO, of course, that gave Pembro its accelerated approval. I think really in looking at the cut points by PD-1 testing using the 22C3 antibody, it was an exploratory look at type of chemotherapy to combine Pembro with. I think it allows more of the safety data of various combinations necessarily rather than thinking about efficacy. To my mind, though, it does raise the challenge of, what way best to check for PD-L1 status. This is something in talking to your audience and particularly people who are general oncologists, I know they've been dealing with this issue in a variety of tumors for a lot longer than we have in breast, but now, we're wrestling with it as well.
I think this is like an exploratory and not a definitive analysis, but the fact that the numbers don't look quite as convincing with the GemCarbo. Any thoughts about this? And also along, we'll talk about in a second about, the Empower studies and paclitaxel and nab-paclitaxel, but what about carbo-paclitaxel plus a Pembro, Kelly? I don't see this on the list.
Right. And I think it was more just trying to take into consideration prior treatments and disease-free interval for, options for chemotherapy partners. And it is the case that GemCarbo didn't look quite as impressive, although was still, better with Pembro added in. I think that it's just good to have the options there for chemo partners to be able to choose.
Well, I want to sort of get into since there wasn't like a huge amount of new data, we saw these data, more analysis from this study. But I really want to get into sort of the nitty gritty of clinical decision making. We'll bring in Atif's case as a way to get into this. But just to remind everybody in terms of what we've seen with Atezo, where you, obviously you see the benefit with nab-paclitaxel, and yet for not 100% clear reasons, you don't see the benefit with paclitaxel. When I first looked at it, the first thing I thought about when I looked at this, Kelly, was so few patients here. I think only like 100 in the control arm. What's your thought about what explains why they saw the benefit with nab and not with paclitaxel?
Well, I have to go with the leading speculation about the steroid exposure as perhaps being the main reason, although you know we haven't necessarily seen that in the early stage setting with paclitaxel or in other combinations with checkpoint agents. It does make me wonder about the difference between targeting PD-1 and PD-L1 between Pembro and Atezo, whether there is some relevant difference in breast cancer based on that. So certainly we don't use paclitaxel in combination with Atezo is, of course, the bottom line clinical take-home lesson. But I think we just need some better understanding and further investigation of why that difference was seen.
So there was one data set at San Antonio that was presented I wanted to get your take on. And this is actually, we saw data in the ovarian cancer with this from the same study, lenvatinib pembro. And Kelly, you can imagine in our GYN series, I feel like that's all we talk about because it's just such an issue with endometrial cancer, people trying to figure out how to use it, but yet you really see some very interesting benefits. And they saw some pretty interesting benefits in ovary where you usually you don't see anything. Anyhow, this was presented, and they presented the cohort from this study. Any thoughts about that? It kind of looks pretty interesting. What do you think?
It does. It's a small study, but that's what small studies are for, is to prompt thought and look at interesting combinations. So lenvatinib, to my understanding, of course, never have used it as a breast cancer physician, but it does seem to be a fairly promiscuous TKI in hitting VEGF and hitting RET. But to have some kind of anti-angiogenesis approach in combination with immunotherapy, you could speculate on a variety of mechanisms of why those two might be synergistic. It was a non-randomized study, so, excuse me. So I think that has to be taken into consideration, but certainly deserves further investigation.
Yeah, and that concept of IO plus anti-angiogenic factor, you see that's very strong in renal, and now you see in HCC. So it's not like we haven't seen it before. Let's start getting into the nitty-gritty of integration of checkpoint inhibitors into the management of metastatic triple-negative disease. So audience, we're going to start out with a straightforward question. We're not going to get into the variations of the PD-L assay. We're just going to say this patient had a positive PD-L1 level. But a young woman gets neoadjuvant anthracycline taxane post-op radiation therapy and now has small volume liver and nodal mets, BRCA wild type, PD-L1 positive. And it looks like the audience strongly favors Atezo NAB. You see Pembro NAB and Pembro paclitaxel also. So it looks like the audience is generally favoring a taxane, the most common being Atezo NAB. And that's the same thing we saw in our investigator survey of 25 people, although we did have several who said Pembro, Gem, and Carbo. And that kind of leads into our case. Before we get to that case, any other thoughts about this clinical scenario, Kelly, and choice of chemo partner?
I think with the survival data from IMpassion 130, it's hard to not turn to the Atezo-NAB combination at this point. And as you pointed out, with Keynote 355, we didn't quite see the same benefit with the carbo-gem combination, even though we have to be careful since it wasn't powered to look at chemo partners. But I think in that circumstance, the currently available data certainly support that combination is the best lead one.
So let's go on. We'll talk about the first case that Atif has. So this is a 50-year-old woman. And, once you start getting into real cases, particularly in practice, nothing is like what it is in the conferences. It's never that straightforward. So, you got a patient, she's got a PD-L1 of 1%, her BRCA is negative, she's got she presents with a 5-centimeter triple negative breast cancer. And she declines neoadjuvant therapy. So, you know, the standard of care, she doesn't want it. And after that, she actually goes through surgery, and you'll hear what happens, but she eventually refused adjuvant therapy. She actually didn't receive adjuvant therapy, and then developed metastatic disease. And what you can see is she actually got started on atezo-nab, but during the first cycle, before cycle two, had LFT abnormalities. Here's Atif with his questions for you, Kelly.
Yeah, I feel like I'm...
You absolutely need neoadjuvant treatment. She said, no, she knows God is gonna cure her. I said, but you know what? At least you need to go back to the surgeon. I was able to convince her to go back to the surgeon. She did, actually. She went, she had surgery, and she was found to have a 5.6 centimeter triple negative, sentinel nodes, two of them negative. She came back to me, and I could not convince her. I was able even to compromise the doses. I was able, I mean, anything to get her to take at least one cycle, but she wouldn't let me. Very nervous lady, very anxious lady. She went to the ED in October with chest pain. They did a CAT scan, and they found a 1.4 centimeter mass in the mid-lung, and a tiny thing in the left. We biopsied it, and, you know, unfortunately, it's triple negative breast cancer, and no disease outside the right mid-lung and this tiny thing in the left. Nothing in the liver, nothing in the bone. I was able to convince her to take chemotherapy this time, PD-L1 of 1%. It started her December 15. This is a very new case. She took cycle 1, day 1 of atezo-nab, no side effects. She took cycle 1, day 8 on December 22nd, but her liver enzymes, they really increased tremendously. I didn't know, is this from the nab-paclitaxel or is this from the atezo? It's really rare from the atezo this quick within 7 days. I thought it's more the nab, but I didn't give her cycle 1 day 15. A week later on December 29, just recently, we repeated her enzymes and they are definitely better. But the question is, wow. Now, what do you do next? Do I stop this regimen completely? Do I add some other chemo to atezo? And honestly, I don't really know the answer. I haven't made up my mind yet. I just saw her.
Well, actually, on Monday, we're doing a webinar with Dr. Kelly Markham from Duke.
I know Kelly very well. He was my fellow when I was attending there.
That's right. You're from Duke. So you know Kelly. Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to present it to him on Monday. Maybe he can give you some ideas.
I really appreciate it because this lady is so nervous. And if I stand in front of her, Neil, I am not like 150% sure. This is not the kind of patient I give her options. Because I'm like so lucky that she allowed me to treat her. Therefore, I want to go in there telling her, I know what you should take.
So Kelly, what does he say? What does he do?
He really put it in context there for the specific patient. I would agree with him. It's so early to see the toxicity from the atezo, but with the LFTs going down, you certainly have to question that. And if I go back to Javier Cortez's slide of adjustment, I think she is in the grade 3 range for hepatic toxicity if we attribute it to the atezo. But I think I would still continue with the Abraxane alone and see if her LFT is more normalized from there. And given the short interval, I might consider crossing over to Pembro with the approval that we have now, just in hopes that maybe we wouldn't get that toxicity with it. We would have to retest with the other antibody, I suppose, to get the approval. But that'd be one thing to think about.
Yeah, that is an interesting thought. Well, we'll see what happens with this case. These always come up. Whenever you start getting cases from practice, you start seeing things you never would imagine. Let's move on now and talk about the second topic that we got into in the webinar, which is the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors in patients with localized triple negative disease. And to me, this has been one of the most controversial areas in breast cancer in general over the past couple of years. One of the things, we could talk a lot about the various assays that are out there. But just kind of curious what we know, and Hope got into this a little bit with how they change over time, PD-L1 status and other markers that we're using, Kelly. Can you use the original tumor, or is it really helpful to get a biopsy specimen?
My general take on the metastatic trials has been that they have used about half the time the metastatic site, and I think for 130 was pretty much even split between metastatic and primary. So in the early stage setting, of course, you go with the primary tumor, but then I guess the data so far for early stage disease are less compelling that PD-L1 status is all that predictive of benefit necessarily. So in the metastatic setting, I'm a believer in assessing the current tumor that you're treating. So I generally get a fresh biopsy when at all possible for rechecking both NGS and PD-L1 status.
So in terms of localized disease, of course, we have data both with Pembro as well as atezolizumab. Maybe you can summarize kind of where we stand right now. There have been a bunch of other neoadjuvant studies done, Kelly. These are the two, I think, that are getting the most attention. We're starting to see maybe a Venfi-free survival benefit. Can you summarize right now where we are with this strategy? And we'll get in a second into the issue of how it interfaces with actual clinical decision-making. But what's your sort of summary, what we know about this strategy?
Well, I think in general, the summary for immunotherapy is earlier is better in general. And what we've seen so far in the preoperative studies and the improvement in PASCR rates that are in the 15% range, 15 to 20% improvement with both atezolizumab and pembrolizumab, there does seem to be a little bit of difference in the data and looking at those studies where they got the anthracycline all up front versus not, as far as the absolute PASCR rates go. But clear indication of seeing an improvement in PASCR and not necessarily predicted by PD-L1 status. So I think the problem with, say, accelerated approval, in this context is just the toxicities, while while not necessarily as common, can be quite significant. And so I think we have to be much more measured in thinking about how we apply these agents now, particularly before any approvals come through. But nevertheless, they clearly have a marked improvement in PASCR. Now, I think there, in general, we know that if you have an immune active triple negative cancer, it's a marker for chemotherapy responsiveness as well. So we are seeing, I think, some of that in all the triple negative preoperative data sets. Just how much we have a predictive marker is, I think, still the open question.
Your point about toxicity is interesting, and these are some of the trials that are continuing to look at this issue, but and adjuvant, not just neoadjuvant. But, it's interesting in terms of, some of these patients are cured. And, it kind of reminds me of when we started to get the adjuvant melanoma data, where initially we heard the investigator, even though it looked in BRAF positive patients like BRAF and immune IOs was going to be similar efficacy-wise, a lot of people were initially leaning to immunotherapy. And then as people started to think about it, they're like, well, they get a complication of immunotherapy. It could be permanent, diabetes, endocrine problems, et cetera. And then maybe some of these people are cured. Any thoughts about that issue in this situation of neoadjuvant therapy, triple negative, Kelly?
Well, it's a challenge we always face in breast cancer. I think if you go back to the British Columbia data, the improvements in hazard ratios, how well, even in triple negative early stage disease, when we get somebody to a PASCR, which we can do pretty well with chemotherapy about half the time, marginal improvements in improving PASCR and contribution to survival, there's a much higher barrier, I think, a higher threshold for us to hit when we're treating breast cancer because of the success of the treatments that we have in our conventional treatments. And so, that's a little, it's not dissimilar from adjuvant melanoma in some ways, but, if you have a high risk melanoma resection, I think you're willing to take a lot more risk because if it becomes metastatic or, it's going to be that much harder to treat.
So let's again go from the data into clinical decision-making. And audience, here's another scenario. You've got a patient with a 6 cm triple-negative breast cancer, positive nodes in the axilla, PD-L1, I don't know how often you see a PD-L1 level that high, but we're going to say it's high or 60%. And so the question is, would you consider either have you already done it or you haven't done it, but you're waiting for the next patient and you will do it? And it looks like the vast majority of the audience is saying They haven't done it yet, but they're waiting for the patient to do it. And actually, when we asked our investigator panel, that's pretty much what they said. I'm curious, any situations right now, Kelly, or have you done this outside of a trial setting?
So I did answer yes to this because I did have a patient with a fairly locally advanced, lots of local regional nodes, subpectoral nodes, who I did give pre-op Abraxane Atezo to, and you know, she did have a really good response. So there are circumstances when it's a really high-risk situation where I think it is justified, but it's that was really much more of a locally advanced, not surgical candidate case, so even a little bit beyond the case. But I do think in high-risk enough situations, it's not the rule by far yet, but there are cases where I think it's worth entertaining if the risk is high enough.
And, you know, it's interesting when we asked the investigator panel, same situation of a big tumor, 6 centimeters, we lowered the PD-L1 level, was still positive, but we said the nodes were negative because in the first case, the nodes were positive. And now you see a big difference in whether people might consider this outside of a trial. Of course, I think if and when there's an approval, things might be very different. But, you know, a lot of times in oncology, you know, you don't see things that often, even breast cancer scenarios you have to wait for, but you kind of have to be ready. And that really is the situation with this next case, because as I found out, the use of an IO in this situation is something Atif wasn't doing. And he's planning on doing it this week because he got a lady coming into clinic and he went through her chart. And so he knows what he's going to be seeing when he sees her. And here's his thought about this case. And his question to you, Kelly.
This is a 44-year-old woman who is presenting with a 4 to 5 centimeter breast cancer that is triple negative with right axillary node, biopsy proven, and her PD-L1 by immunohistochemistry 22C3 is 8%. Her imaging studies, no distant mets outside the breast and the axilla. What would you recommend as neoadjuvant treatment for this patient?
So she hasn't been treated. You're going to see her next week, and you're thinking that you want to give her Pembro plus carboplatin.
Correct.
Have you done that before?
No.
So you've probably been thinking about this before, and now here it is, right?
That's exactly right. You read the article, you see, okay, when am I going to get next patient triple negative? Because we really need something more than just chemotherapy.
Any questions? I'm going to maybe present this one to Kelly. Any questions you want to put to him?
Yeah, the question really, after neoadjuvant pembrolizumab carboplatin paclitaxel, how do you decide what type of adjuvant treatment do you give? How do you incorporate the treatment with capecitabine based on the adjuvant capecitabine data? How do you incorporate the immune checkpoint inhibitor after surgery?
So I'd add a question to that, which is what about carboplatin pembrolizumab to start with as a combination? So would you like to give some assistance here?
Well, I'm right on the edge with Atif in thinking about this. I think we all are in the breast community. 44-year-old presenting with palpable axillary nodes, I would give it serious consideration now as well. I would use carboplatin Pembro, most likely, consistent with KEYNOTE-522. I think, the risk justifies it. You know, it's interesting in reflecting on that other case, why the node negative patient, maybe you wouldn't push it there, I think is a reflection of the appreciation of the heterogeneity of triple negative disease. I mean, if you've got a 6 centimeter tumor confined to the breast, you have to wonder about the biology and what the true risk is. This is a 44-year-old, I'm assuming, her genetic status doesn't really matter from a systemic therapy standpoint. I think, it's well worth considering the risk-benefit. But I think it's a balanced discussion with the patient, knowing that we don't even have event-free or disease-free survival data necessarily strongly yet, but that the past CR data are fairly compelling. I think that... some of the neoadjuvant data does suggest that it's appropriate to give the anthracycline up front also, that if you're going to give all your systemic therapy, you should just go ahead and give it all up front. And if you think it's a high risk enough situation to give an immune checkpoint agent, and to push the boundary on that, then it's a reasonable high risk enough situation to give the anthracycline as well. And I would then use that to guide the Outback capecitabine recommendations a la CREATE-X. I have not been giving concurrent capecitabine radiation, even in a case like this, particularly with a robust clinical response with preoperative chemotherapy. But if she had residual disease, I would offer the capecitabine out back and finish out with a year of Pembro as well. That gets a little tricky, but I would think about approaching it that way.
So we're getting some good questions in the chat room. Kelly, maybe you can consider a couple of them. One from Uzma: has a patient with metastatic triple negative breast cancer and ITP. Would you be concerned about using atezo in a patient with worsening, about making the ITP worse?
I have to confess, I would have to look through the literature and see what data are available. And I don't know of any. So I would probably still think about using it, but I would want to make sure that I've not overlooked something in the literature there.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I'm trying to think of even in other tumors where I've heard anything about concurrent ITP and checkpoint inhibitors. So that'll go in our try to figure it out. Here's another one. Patient with a T1A, this is more an adjuvant question, but still I think important. T1A, triple negative breast cancer, 4 millimeters, Ki 67, 80%.
I'm a fairly aggressive small TNBC treating tumor. The British Columbia series, the NCCN series have suggested, in that mid T1B, T1A range, that there's still a 15%, recurrence risk, enough of a risk in certainly in a person who's otherwise healthy, who you expect is going to live beyond 5 years, to think about that. I would probably approach it with just, TC as the regimen, but I would discuss it, yes.
So let's go on to our next topic that we covered in the webinar. Again, not like a whole huge amount of stuff that came out at San Antonio, but still an important topic, particularly in triple negative breast cancer, the use of PARP inhibitors. And just, one issue that we got questions about after the last webinar, Kelly, was patients with somatic mutations. And of course, now in ovarian cancer, there's a lot of data out there right now. The benefit of PARP inhibitors, really, patients with somatic BRCA, even LOH scores are getting PARP inhibitors. But I don't know how much data is out there in other cancers, including breast cancer. And you all had presented this TBCRC study, 48. It looked like you saw responses in non-BRCA mutations. And I think at the same time in the last ASCO meeting, we saw kind of similar data, not exactly the same, but in the same vein with talazoparib. Any thoughts, Kelly, about this issue of treating patients with somatic mutations?
If you pick up a somatic BRCA1 or 2 mutation on next generation sequencing in a metastatic lesion, it's on the list of options to use. It is always a metastatic disease. We have to acknowledge we work through therapies in sequence. And so I don't hung up so much on treatment order, although the sequencing of when you use it following platinum therapy, I think, is of some importance. I presented a case of a somatic mutation that was in the TBCRC 48 study. I think Joyce kind of challenged me on whether it was really somatic or not, but went back and looked at the data, and it's convincing that it is, who's had a quite long duration of response of, over a year. So I have to admit, I was skeptical that this entity existed until sensitive next generation sequencing came to be available, but they're out there and they do seem to respond to PARP inhibitors. So I do think it's worth a try in those patients.
So we got a question in the chat room about when are we going to see adjuvant data? And we have two big trials out there, the Olympia studies. What are they looking at, Kelly? When do you think they'll report? And would you like to make some predictions?
Oh gosh, on the adjuvant, on the heels of the adjuvant CDK4/6 study, I think we should all be quite humble about predictions in these situations. But the Olympia trial basically took patients who had BRCA1 or 2 related germline mutated breast cancer and gave them Outback elipirib following either adjuvant or preoperative therapy. And the criteria were such that, I mean, you had to have pretty high risk disease. You had to have residual disease if you had preoperative therapy and lymph node involvement or a large tumor if you were getting it adjuvantly. So my prediction would be that we are going to see, well, it's a challenge because these are chemotherapy sensitive tumors for the most part. So the patients who made it into it have kind of shown, at least some of them, their non-responsiveness to chemotherapy. I suspect that it's going to show some improvement in relapse-free survival, though, but I'm afraid the effect is going to be rather modest because the biology is being selected out in the way to find the most aggressive of the aggressive. The toxicity data are going to be important as well, because even if the adjuvant data are negative, I don't think that necessarily closes the door ultimately on some kind of prevention strategy, although the leukemia risk has got to be clearly defined as being somewhere in the range of acceptable.
And also maybe stage four NED situations where you have a tumor taken out, which actually is a situation I see in the chat room right now from Arun. This is not a BRCA patient, at least it doesn't say, but what the question is, systemic treatment of patient with a single brain met, status spoke stereotactic radiation therapy, triple negative disease. And I'd widen that out to say in general, stage four NED, Kelly.
Yeah, well, for stage four NED for TNBC in particular is a challenging scenario. So, gosh, I wish we could open this up for discussion because I'm facing that exact prospect right now in a patient of mine who relapsed with solitary brain met out of ER positive disease, but triple negative on the brain, the disease in the brain. I'm going to consider giving them systemic therapy, and I am checking PD-L1 status on the brain metastasis and kind of working with our brain metastasis group, contemplating whether a quasi-adjuvant immunotherapy regimen would be appropriate. So, the devil's in the details on the patient side here too, if they're appropriate candidate for it. But I likely will treat the patient that I'm dealing with pretty much that exact scenario right now.
And you do have a fantastic brain metastasis group there. One more thing before we get back into sort of clinical decision making in terms of new directions. One thing I keep hearing about, I hear about this in ovary also, is the idea of PARP plus IO. I hear about the STING pathway at San Antonio. I always love the trials in progress at San Antonio. They talked about this 009 study. Yeah. Any thoughts about sort of the theoretical or clinical basis for this strategy, Kelly?
Well, I think it has a lot of attractive features to it. So that trial, similar to a study called the DORA study that Rebecca Dent and Sarah Sammons at Duke and Singapore have done together, finished up accruing in December, that's taking patients who've demonstrated sensitivity to platinum therapy and then treating with olaparib plus or minus durvalumab. So the same kind of maintenance type strategy. I don't see a real reason why it shouldn't actually work well because we are selecting out in the Keeling study does as well in its design, selecting out those patients who've demonstrated responsiveness to platinum-based therapy. And so as long as they haven't developed any resistance mechanisms, one would hope that you would get some activation of the immune system in combination with the PARP inhibitor and activating the STING pathway and getting neoantigen formation in a HRD tumor, and that would then be a nice Freund's adjuvant for inducing an immune response with the immune checkpoint agent. So it's going to be very exciting to see the results from both those studies. And it's similar to what the ovarian people have done. And I know there it may be more of a challenge. It seems to be a modest benefit that they've seen. I'm hopeful about that strategy for these breast triple negative cases as well.
So let's get back into clinical decision-making. Hal Burstein from Dana-Farber always kids me that I make up these scenarios and ask people about, but you hardly ever see them. Well, this is Atif's next case, 41-year-old. He always tells me you never see the 41-year-old woman with a germline BRCA mutation. Well, actually, this is not his exact case yet. We'll get to his case.
Yeah.
Who gets neoadjuvant AC chemotherapy, post-op radiation therapy, and now presents with liver, lung, and nodal mets. So the patient's got a germline mutation, prior neoadjuvant therapy. Audience, what would be your strategy in this situation? And it looks like most of the audience is saying atezo nab or a pembro chemo like they did before. Same thing with the faculty. Any thoughts about this? I mean, obviously you would expect also benefit from a PARP inhibitor. When we've asked this question before, a lot of people bring up the survival benefit that's been seen with chemo IO as the rationale.
Yeah, it's hard to not be convinced by the survival data. Although, again, you know, in IMpassion 130, if you looked at the mutation carriers, it didn't appear to predict a response, and it seemed to correlate more with PD-L1 status. You know, I think you're going to use both in sequence in some way. So do we really know that going at this patient with a PARP inhibitor first is really going to undercut that in the same way chemotherapy seems to? We don't know that yet. So I think I'd probably put PARP inhibitor on that just to be controversial. Although in point of fact, I think you have to look at the survival benefit and go with the atezo nab combination first. But in truth, we're going to combine them in sequence regardless. So I think either option has merit to it.
So, you know, another factor that comes in is just reflecting back on the last issue of our podcast. I was talking with Dave Quinn from USC in Los Angeles about what life is like around Los Angeles nowadays in terms of COVID and access to hospitalization. So at least, you know, because you are looking at oral versus IV therapy here. And in some situations, obviously, we've learned this past year, a lot of people favor oral. Here's another scenario. So the same situation, audience. The patient gets a atezo nab, like most of you said you wanted to do, but then has disease progression 29 months later. Again, BRCA germline and PD-L1 positive. What do you think your next therapy would be? And everybody's saying PARP inhibitor, but what I was curious about was which one. So actually, quite a few people say coin flip. But of the about half the audience says coin flip, you know, they can't, it's either one. But of the other half, most of them prefer laparib. And a lot of times you hear people choosing what they're used to from other situations. And you know, I guess you could say the faculty really isn't much different in terms of their thought about choice. Any way you can distinguish these two, Kelly? I mean, at the beginning, we were hearing about maybe hair thinning with talazoparib, but I don't know. Is there any way to separate these two out?
You know, there does seem to be a little bit more marrow suppression with talazoparib. Is it more active? I don't know. I think we're all still getting a familiarity with the PARP inhibitors in everyday clinical practice. So I certainly answered coin flip on this one. And in all honesty, it, as the drugs first became available, it was contingent on making sure I could get the drug in the patient's hands and where it was going to be provided from that ended up influencing my decision. So I have equipoise clinically, but some of those logistical questions ended up being more pertinent.
I'm curious, we were talking about situations where you would use a PARP inhibitor in a patient with a germline mutation other than BRCA. We asked, let's ask the audience, actually, how about PALB2 audience, germline PALB2? Would you attempt to use a PARP inhibitor in a patient like that? And if you have, or whether you haven't, but you would for the right patient, looks like the vast majority of the audience say they haven't, but they would for the right patient. I think we learned that lesson maybe from Overy, but the faculty seems completely split on how, well, no, actually, you think about it, they either have or they would. So they're actually on board with the audience as well. Audience, how about germline ATM? Same thing. If would you use it or have you used it? And you see, you know, I'm curious, Kelly, from your point of view, what are the mutations right now that you feel comfortable treating? Here they say, the faculty says germline ATM, no. What are your thoughts, Kelly?
I'd agree. We did have within the TBCRC48 study a cohort of ATM patients. In fact, that was the most commonly treated mutation, that and CHEK2. And there really wasn't any compelling, even anecdotal evidence of activity there. And I think the other disease sites like prostate, where it's been looked at, kind of lumped cases together in the analysis. So I'm skeptical, and there doesn't seem to be a compelling case that ATM has a lot of susceptibility to PARP inhibition.
So one more thing we asked the faculty, as you might guess, somatic BRCA, everybody's on board. Either they've already done it or they will for the right patient. Let's get to Atif's third patient. So this is a lady who's got a metastatic triple negative disease, germline BRCA1, PD-L1 of 2%. And here's what happened with this patient.
I had a very long discussion with her what to do next. And obviously, the two options here are atezo, nab-paclitaxel versus a PARP inhibitor. And she was clear cut. She wasn't going to take chemotherapy. And she was on olaparib.
And what's her current situation?
She's excellent. She is now around 9 months on 300 milligram POBID, mild nausea. I don't really use a prophylactic anti-emetic. And her anemia, she went down to 9 point something gram per deciliter. But now it's back up to 11.9. She's doing fantastic, and she is in a very good PR on olaparib. And the question is, what do we know about IO chemotherapy after a PARP inhibitor?
Wow. Any family history?
No, absolutely not.
Wow. Any questions you'd like to hear discussed by Kelly, because I'm going to present this one to him too, about this scenario or this case?
How do you incorporate PARP inhibitors in triple negative breast cancer? You know, what line would you use it? You know, single agent, they are not going to be a home run.
So, the art of oncology here. Any thoughts about the case and also Atif's questions?
Well, I think it's a great demonstration of why you need to put the tools in the hands of excellent medical oncologists who work with their patients to figure out how best to manage them. And I'm on rounds with Atif trying to butter him up again, I guess. But he's just demonstrating that. He talked to the patient and figured out what they'd be willing to work with. And in time, she'll probably come to accept getting some kind of IV chemotherapy. The question of sequencing after PARP progression, we are early days. We need to I personally feel like it's very important to resequence those patients at progression and see, is the mechanism of resistance of BRCA reversion, of which we've identified within the Duke practice now, it's somewhere around 6 revertant mutations that we've been able to demonstrate on next-gen sequencing after progression on the PARP inhibitor. But there's certainly some who progress on PARP inhibitor who don't develop a reversion. It may still be platinum sensitive and have a different resistance mechanism. So that, to my mind, does strongly influence how to sequence those things. But if you didn't start with IO therapy to begin with, I think it creates probably a good biologic scenario for being able to add the PARP and add an IO agent on the heels of the PARP, even if we don't have a lot of data yet. The HOPE study and the DORA study, I think, will speak to that to some degree.
So back to the chat room. Anita says that they have a patient who has a PIK3 mutation that's triple negative. Have you seen that? What do you do?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we got the importunity results at San Antonio showing that the AKT inhibitor, patisiran, did not succeed in that trial in combination with chemotherapy. And that, I think, based on the phase 2 results, we were all very hopeful that that was going to be a positive study. So again, humility reigns. So I have not otherwise tried to incorporate any kind of PI3 kinase inhibitor, alpelisib, into treatment of triple negative breast cancer off protocol.
So here's an awesome question. I was thinking about this actually. Divya says, would you use a PARP inhibitor in a patient who has a foundation assay showing LOH, loss of heterozygosity? Of course, in ovarian cancer, this is an important assay. Determining whether or not they're going to use, for example, a niraparib. What about in breast cancer?
Yeah, I wouldn't use it just based on that. I understand the temptation, but I think we You know, we need follow-up on things like the SWOG study to see if that BRCA-ness assay, of which LOH is really just one of the components, is really predictive of benefit from a PARP inhibitor. And to this point, I just don't think we have the data to justify
that. So Nicholas in the chat room wants you to comment on the creatinine increase that's seen with, quote, PARP inhibitors, although I don't know. I think I've heard about with rucaparib and maybe olaparib. This is kind of like a pseudo increase in creatinine because of transport or something in the kidney. Yeah. Well, how do you approach, how often do you see creatinine bumps and what do you do about it?
Yeah, I have not seen that as an issue with either talazoparib or olaparib to this point. I'll have to go back and look at that. I don't remember it being reported out in the registration studies either. But like many drugs where that happens, you just monitor it and can keep going.
Arun wants to know about, we were hearing about this in the past. I haven't heard too much recently. Androgen receptor inhibition antagonists.
Yes. So, you know, we know there's definitely this luminal-like androgen receptor triple negative subtype where it would seem to be a tractable target. I think the challenge has been finding the right assay for really determining that a tumor is androgen receptor driven. You know, Tiffany Traina at Memorial has, I think, done the most work on this. She and Rita Nanda have a study in the TBCRC investigating androgen receptor blockade and comparing it to chemotherapy. So I think I have on occasion used it, particularly in older patients where I have ordered the androgen receptor, acknowledging it's maybe practicing a little in front of the data, but in patients with relatively indolent disease where it seems like it may be that luminal AR subtype, where I don't think there's much harm, you know, in trying to get enzalutamab and treat them for a period of time. You know, if they have just solitary, you know, minimal lung metastases and slow progression. But it's special cases, I would have to say.
Alicia in the chat room wants to know any benefits to trying an IO in a heavily pretreated patient with an weak ER positivity if the PD-L1 is high. I mean, I think there are a lot of times that people just want to try IOs in any patient who's, you know, run out of options. This one's like, well, there's a little bit ER positive. Can we still do it?
Yeah, you can if you can get it covered. Have to say, if somebody was heavily pretreated in that situation, I would probably be more tempted to try sacituzumab than I would be to go to an IO if they were, you know, beyond three lines of treatment.
So speaking of sacituzumab, one other thing that came out, we saw a little bit of data, not very much though, at San Antonio, is in terms of beyond, you know, IOs, PD-L1 negative, people already had IOs. We talked about eribulin. And Joyce presented a great case of a patient who had a great response to it. We talked a little bit about the EMBRACE trial, but then we also talked about sacituzumab. And I'm just curious right now in terms of sequencing where people are at. Sarah Hurvitz presented some data on sacituzumab in terms of predictors. Maybe you can just comment on that first, because I guess that was a little disappointing.
Well, I guess it's always how to look at the glass between half full and half empty. I think we all intuitively want to have biomarkers because it makes us feel like we know what we're doing. And you know, you would assume that higher expression of the target would correlate with response, but Sarah and Sarah Hurvitz took a very careful look at this out of the ASCENT study, and the degree of expression of TROP2 just didn't really have any statistical significant correlation with response. So the half full version is, well, that means you can use it in all triple negative disease. So that's a good thing. But I, you know, for the antibody drug conjugates, you know, beyond her too, it's challenging to know what the, you know, whether we have to have a marker for predicting response, and so, hopefully it'll have activity outside of triple negative disease as well.
So let's see where the audience is in terms of patients going beyond chemo IO in the first line. So audience, you have a 60-year-old patient, BRCA wild type, PD-L1 positive, disease progression after IO chemo. What's next for you? I'm curious. It looks like a lot of people, well, it looks like it's kind of split between sacituzumab, capecitabine, and eribulin, and platinum-based chemo. Actually, sacituzumab looks like it has the most votes, but you see a substantial number of people, a number of these choices. The faculty was more oriented towards sacituzumab or platinum-based chemo. This is the art of oncology. Kelly, what's your usual second and third line therapy?
Well, I'll move sacituzumab up early if I can get it covered. So that's always a key consideration. Given the duration of response, I think it is appropriate to use it as early as you can.
What about the sequencing of capecitabine versus eribulin? It looked like eribulin had more efficacy in the triple negative patients, but which one comes first? I mean, capecitabine is oral, obviously attractive. How do you, and as you say, maybe a lot of patients are going to get both, but how do you think about that one, Kelly?
I do use capecitabine fairly early in the course too, but it's just always struck me that there's such historical accidentness to the order of development of agents and what sequence we use them in. I wish we had better biologic ways is my kind of dodge answer to that, to really be able to select the appropriate course. And I think with next generation sequencing and immunotherapy, I think it begins to split off into enough different potential paths that it becomes a little challenging to say, well, I use capecitabine here or I use it there, because they're beginning to develop into so many different subtypes, even within triple negative disease. So I'm almost always going to use it probably second, third line. But I think the future is fairly clear that the antibody drug conjugates are going to be the preferred earlier agents to use.
So Arun wants to know how you treat a patient who gets neoadjuvant chemo and then recurs. Do you go back to chemo or do you go to something like sacituzumab? I mean, if you assume you could access it.
Right. If I could access it, I would think about using it earlier, particularly if it's someone with triple negative disease, recurs less than 6 months, even though the ASCENT study didn't let those patients in. There's some data coming for those, quick recurrence patients. But if someone's got an anthracycline, taxane, cyclophosphamide, platinum-based therapy, I just don't have a lot of confidence about their response to conventional chemo and would try to get a sacituzumab.